Blog Talk Radio.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you.
This is Leslie Kiss, and you're on the air with Alice McCoy. She is a descendant of John Brown, and I apologize for the background noise. We are both on the road. Alice is on her way, or she may already be in Harper's Ferry, and I'm on my way to Jersey. So, Alice, I'm going to mute myself out just to make this interview a little more smoother. Could you introduce yourself?
Of course. My name is Alice Kesey McCoy, and I am a great-great-great-granddaughter of John Brown, the abolitionist.
Okay. How was it when you learned about John Brown, and how old were you? Can you tell us some of your earliest recollections of discovering who John Brown?
Well, actually, my family doesn't talk about it much, so I did not know I was related to John Brown until I was 16 years old. My grandmother worked on a quilt that had a square about Harper's Ferry in it, and it was written up in the newspaper when it went on display, and a local historian found it, Jean Libby. She contacted my grandmother and interviewed her and took some pictures, and then made arrangements to take pictures of the rest of the family. While she was taking my picture when I was 16, Jean realized I didn't really know anything about John Brown, and so she spent about 2 hours telling me about the great man and setting me down a great path of research of John Brown.
Did you ever discover why your family did not tell you about John Brown?
Part of it goes back to Annie. Annie, when she first moved to California and had her children, tried to protect her children from the John Brown reference. So she didn't talk much about being related. As she got older in her later years, she did talk about John Brown and her relationship, but she didn't talk about it, and the family kept it quiet due to embarrassment, shame, and just because Annie had never talked about it.
Well, I can relate to your sentiments. I also wrote a book, and in my preface, I state that my great-great-grandmother, who is from West Virginia, would not talk about her past and why she had three aliases. So I clearly understand what was going on in your family. Now, when you did discover John Brown, tell me, what was the first piece of treasure that you really, really remember and saying, I got to keep this, I got to share this, you know, when did that happen to you?
I started researching it a little bit. Again, I was 16, so when you're 16, you don't really care much about history. But I did some research, found out that there was a Bible in our family that had belonged to John Brown's son, Oliver. And my sister had that, and I now have it in my possession. Researching, I found that he was a great man, because what I had learned in school was he was the crazy guy with his arms outstretched. He was, you know, trying to incite World War III or the Civil War. He actually was much more complex than that. When I realized he was for equality, that's when the spark really went off in my head. He wasn't just for freeing the slaves. He was for equality of all people, including women, which was very radical.
Now, can you give us a specific article or letter or something that you remember making you have these sentiments? You know, was it one letter that you read, or you know, was it something in the Bible that made you clearly understand he was about equality?
I wish it was one great aha moment. It's been over a number of years in reading various letters and reading various articles about him that I've realized that he was for equality of all people.
Oh, okay. But there's not one letter or nothing you can reference to that made you come up with that conclusion. It's just that the compilation of everything, you came to that conclusion at the age of 16?
Actually, it was probably closer to 25.
Okay.
There was a time in there, I was 16, and 16-year-olds don't like to study history.
Okay. And how did you feel when you discovered that he was about equality compared to what you were told in school? Did you ever have an opportunity to tell your educators that you were related and what you had discovered was not true as far as what they've been teaching you?
No, I never got an opportunity. I was out of high school by the time that I figured out that I was related to John Brown and what he really stood for. Now, my children have had that opportunity. When they were in high school, I read what was in their history books and made them go and tell their teachers that some of this was wrong and they needed to correct it.
Okay. Now, let's correct history right now for the many listeners that are listening to your voice as a descendant. What are some of the myths that you just cannot stand and you think that should be corrected? Can you go down your top three, David Letterman's top three type of myths that you need to bust right now?
The first one would be that he was crazy. He was not crazy. He was very adamant and very excited in his hatred of slavery, but insanity has been 99.9% ruled out of his entire life. That would be number one. Number two, that he was a terrible businessman. He was probably not the best businessman in the world, but he suffered with, like everyone else, through the recessions of the 1800s, some of which were as severe as what we're in this, here now in 2009. And so all of his business failures weren't always because he couldn't manage the business. Sometimes the market just fell out from under him. A third one, those are the two big ones. I don't know that I have a third one.
Okay, well, I was mistaken. I should have introduced you in conjunction with the celebration. Could you tell everybody about the Harper's Ferry commemoration that's going on right now?
Sure. It actually starts next week. On the academics part of it starts on Wednesday. It is the 150th anniversary of the raid on Harper's Ferry that John Brown and his men made. It is at the Harper's Ferry National Park. There's an academic symposium for Wednesday through Saturday, and I am presenting a paper on Wednesday on the women in John Brown's life. And then throughout the whole week and actually through the end of the year, there are various events going on commemorating the raid, his trial, his funeral. All the information about what's going on and where it's located is on the website, johnbrownraid.org, and you can get information on what's going on at the park and all the surrounding areas and all the great events that are going on this week and through the end of the year.
Have you found a growing interest in John Brown, either in a positive way or in a negative way, in the recent years? And if you have, explain to us how it has affected you personally.
Sure. Actually, there seems to be a lot more interest in him in the past probably 5 or 6 years. It's funny how the interest in John Brown fluctuates. Right after his raid, there was a lot of negative books about him and interest in him. Then for a while, he was a nicer person in some of the books, and he was made to be a devil again in some of the books. And now we pretty well have come to a medium point where, you know, we're understanding that he was a man, and these are things that he did as a man, that he wasn't good or evil. Many books have come out in the past 3 years on John Brown. I know of at least six that have been published just in the past year, because this is the sesquicentennial year. Actually, I'm writing a book and had hoped to have it out this year, but I'm not going to make it till next year.
Okay, what is one of your favorite John Brown books?
I would have to say that anything by Louis DeCaro is a great read. He focuses more on his religious background, but the best book is Abolitionist by David S. Reynolds. It's subtitled The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. And it is probably the best biography on John Brown on the market these days.
Can you repeat the gentleman's name, the author's name?
Sure. His name is David S. Reynolds.
Okay. Thanks for sharing it. I'll be sure to add that to my collection. Now, let's talk about the Harper's Raid and everything you know I want to share with the audience about the Harper's Raid, because many people don't even know what we're talking about at this point.
Okay, well, in 1859, on October 16th, John Brown and 20 young men marched from Maryland to Harper's Ferry with the intent of taking the arsenal, the United States federal arsenal that was there, taking the weapons, and then escaping into the forest, the Shenandoah Valley Forest, and setting up renegade camps where they could take freed slaves to start freeing slaves slowly in the area, giving them arms, and hoping that the ultimate hope was that all the slaves in the area and throughout the South would start to rebel against their masters, and, you know, through a force of numbers, they would become free. Unfortunately, John Brown, was so concerned with the welfare of his hostages that he took that he waited too long to get out of the firehouse, which is now known as John Brown's Fort, and he ended up getting trapped. They held off for 3 days. They held off against the whole town and Robert E. Lee's army, or battalion, I mean. They finally had a gun battle, and two of John Brown's sons were killed in the battle. John was injured when he was taken hostage. He was put on trial, found guilty of treason and murder and inciting a slave revolt. And on December 2nd, he was hung in the state of West Virginia.
Now, these men that he gathered to be a part of his raid, what was the ethnicity and what was the demographics, the percentage of, you know, the races, if you know?
Primarily white, but he did have five blacks that were with him. They were all young. Most of them were 40 and under. They all shared the same view as he did, that America should be this wonderful land of the free where everyone was free. And they honestly thought that this was a way that they were going to get their message across.
Now, you mentioned earlier that he was a religious man. How did that come into play with this raid and taking up arms in his religion?
He didn't want to kill anyone, and his orders to the men were, you know, do not, you know, try your best not to kill anyone. He just felt that the peaceful talking and the peaceful negotiations had no longer worked. If it had gone exactly the way he wanted, there would have been no gunshots and no bloodshed. He would have just taken the weapons and left, and it would have had a different outcome. But unfortunately, he got stuck.
Now, what were the incidents which led him to the brink and the decision to have this raid? Weren't there a few incidents that led him to say, this is our last recourse?
Well, he had been fighting slavery his whole life. He was 59 years old, and he didn't see anything getting any better. I don't know why he picked this exact moment in time. I'm sorry, I don't. But he had just reached what he felt was the point of no return, that if they didn't do something drastic, slavery would never end.
Okay, how I depicted it in my book, The Gist of Freedom is Still Safe, one of the incidents which he was retaliating against was Bloody Kansas, or some people call it Bleedy Kansas. Are you familiar with Bloody Kansas?
Yes.
Okay, could you tell the audience what, could you just describe that incident and how it related to John Brown's raid?
Well, that was in 1855, 4 years before the raid. His sons had gone to Kansas to homestead out there to help make the Kansas a non-slavery state when it was added to the Union. They requested John Brown come and help them because they were literally being attacked by the pro-slavers. He brought out food, horses, and guns for his sons, and he stayed for a few months and helped them battle with the pro-slavery people. Most famous are Potawatomi, where he and a group of men basically massacred five of the pro-slavers in retaliation of the threats that were being made against him and his family. The pro-slavers were threatening to kill them and to burn down their houses and to burn down the town. Osawatomi happened after the pro-slavers burned down the city of Lawrence. There was bloodshed, there was fighting, there was also a battle at Blackjack that happened in Kansas. All of this was to prevent the Missourian pro-slavers from settling in the state to make it a pro-slave state. Unfortunately, it involved bloodshed. Yes.
Now, it seems as though John Brown was involved with a lot of violent ways of defending himself and defending the slaves. How was these incidents different? Harper's Ferry doesn't seem too much different from Bloody Kansas.
I'm sorry, you broke up really bad on the last part. I'm sorry.
Oh. Okay, I said, how were the two incidents different, Harper's Ferry versus Bloody Kansas?
Well, Bloody Kansas was in defense and protection of him and his family, whereas Harper's Ferry was him taking arms up and giving them to the slaves, like I said, was his actual plan, so that he was there was no retaliation involved in Harper's Ferry. It was to be a strictly go in, get the weapons, and get out type of operation so that he could arm the slaves to help them gain their freedom.
Now, wasn't there an incident on the floor of Congress with Senator Charles Sumner? What was their relationship? I'll let you explain the Charles Sumner incident and his relationship to John Brown.
I have not studied that in detail. I'm sorry. I don't really know.
Okay, Charles Sumner was beat viciously on the floor of Congress for complaining about Bloody Kansas, and he was caned and left to bleed to death on the floor of Congress. And some readings have said that John Brown was upset about that, as well as Bloody Kansas in all the bloodshed of the many nonviolent anti-slavery abolitionists. So I was wondering if you knew anything, if it was true, or if you had read anything about Charles Sumner's relationship with John Brown.
I don't, but I bet Jean Libby will when you chat with her.
Oh, okay. We will chat tomorrow. I hope you'll be part of that conversation as well. You know, you're listening.
Okay.
Now, what are you excited about the most about this symposium? And have you done similar work?
No, this is my first time attending or presenting at an academic symposium, and I'm very thrilled. I really have no academic background. My research is just 30 years of research I've done on my own based on John Brown and his family, and mostly the women in his family. I'm hoping, though, looking at what some of the other speakers are presenting papers on, to learn a great deal more about John Brown and his relationship with the people around him and how he was perceived at the time.
Okay, now can you tell us about the women that was the most influential people in his life?
Sure. The most influential, in my opinion, is his wife, Mary. They were married for 20-plus years. They had 13 children. Mary believed in what he was doing and was an abolitionist and a suffragette in her own right. She would stay at home and take care of the children and raise the children in the way that he wanted so that he was able to go around the country and raise money to fight slavery and to bring awareness to slavery. Not that he deserted her, but he left with her blessing because he was doing such good work. And she, actually the last 5 years of his life, she and her younger children lived in North Elba, New York, in the black community that was set up by Garrett Smith, sometimes called Timbuktu. And they lived there without any contact with John Brown other than letters for 5 years. In and around with the black people, teaching them how to farm, how to live on the land, how to build houses, and helping them to really get established up there. So of all the women in his life, she actually was the most influential and the most gave the most to him so that he could do what he needed, what he felt he needed to do.
Well, that's a powerful, powerful story. I've never heard anything like that before. Now, what town did she move to in New York?
North Elba, E-L-B-A, North Elba, which is where the John Brown Farm still stands today, and it's a historical site. It's right outside Lake Placid. It's a beautiful area.
Does your family have any property? And do you visit, do you have any roots up in Elba, North Elba, right?
It's North Elba. No, I don't. In 1865, Mary and her four youngest children moved from North Elba to California, and that is where my line of the family is Ben Simpson, is in Northern California.
Now, were there any indications in Northern California, of, you know, your legacy, the family's legacy? Did you continue with any civil rights movements? Are there any hints that, you know, that later on when you're 16, you said, wow, now I understand, you know, why my family was involved with civil rights, because it's, you know, in our blood. Did that ever happen to you, or did you guys just say, we lost a lot of family members to that type of activity, and we just really want to forgive and bury it?
Well, I don't know that it was an active decision to not participate, but I will tell you that the values of John Brown were definitely passed down through my family. I joke with my father and tell him that my grade school pictures look like a miniature UN. I grew up in a part of California where I went to school with people from Africa, Germany, Spain, China, Japan, Korea. I mean, I learned how to speak all these other languages when I was a young kid, and I learned to eat all these really exotic foods, and I just thought everyone's family was like that, that everyone had friends of all colors, and everyone had friends that were from different places. It never occurred to me that that's not the norm. So I grew up with my family believing in the ideals of John Brown, and the neighborhood we grew up in was perfect for that because, like I said, it was a miniature United Nations.
Now, where is this?
Palo Alto, California.
I heard of that.
Stanford University's there.
That's kind of a high-tech area, isn't it, for technology?
Yes, it's where Silicon Valley starts, and it's also where Stanford University is, yes.
Excellent. Now, have you been up to North Alba, New York?
Yes, I had a chance to go last year to actually see the house and take the tour and sit on the bench and reflect on the fact that this was, you know, where my family's history was. I took a tour of the house, and they told me about parts of it being replaced from age, being repair and all of that. And they did tell me that the floorboards were original, so I kicked off my shoes so that I could stand on the floorboards that my ancestors had stood on.
Oh, that's awesome. That's just wonderful. And your children, were they there with you standing on those floorboards?
I stood on them, yes. I loved it. It was wonderful.
Any other relatives stood on the floorboards with you?
I'm sorry, you cut out again.
I'm sorry. Did any other of your relatives also have the opportunity to stand on the floorboards?
No, in my immediate family, I'm the only one who really embraces this whole John Brown relationship. My dad, my father, and my sister acknowledge it, but they don't do anything to participate in it. No one else has been, my immediate family has been to the farm. I know that many other descendants have been there.
Well, how does that make you feel? Were you excited about something that you learned and you don't have anybody in your family to share with? Where they said, oh boy, here she goes again. You know, what do they do? How do they, you know, let you know kindly that they're really not into this? And who do you share your stories and your excitement with?
Well, they do listen to me and share some of my excitement. They just don't want to participate in any of the items where it involves talking and being in the public. But through my research of the genealogy of John Brown, I have discovered hundreds of cousins all over the United States, and they're who I really communicate with.
So that's awesome. So do you go out and do you guys meet on a regular basis annually or biannually?
Well, there used to be until the 1960s, starting in the 1920s, there was a Brown reunion held every year. It stopped happening in the 1960s. And I've talked to a few of my cousins, and I think that rather than try to make it a reunion that we all attend, we're going to try to make it more of an online community. I'm hoping to really, you know, meet up and catch up with a lot of different people at Harper's Ferry and kind of work out some of the details of that we would have a community online. Since in this day and age, it's so difficult for everyone to get away with their business and their kids, so we would mostly meet online.
Now, are you on Facebook?
I am.
Okay. Do you want to share your Facebook address?
It's A. Mecoy. Actually, my Facebook address, I think, is Alice Keezy Mecoy. Isn't that funny? I don't even know my address.
I don't know mine either. So have you been able to communicate with a lot of Brown, John Brown family members and fans and scholars on Facebook and online?
On Facebook, it is Alice Keezy Mecoy. On Facebook, I'm in contact with probably about 20 of my relatives. Email-wise, I have over 100 that I communicate with and probably a core group of about 20 scholars that I communicate with.
Now, let's talk more about your book, your upcoming book.
Okay.
Do you want to? I'll let you talk about how you got started and how much research you've been putting into it.
All right. Well, my book is a continuation of the paper that I'm presenting at Harper's Ferry. It will be on the women of John Brown's life, focusing primarily on the women in my direct line, which is through Annie Brown, his daughter. And I've been very blessed in the fact that my great aunt, who's also named Alice, is 94 years old and used to live with Annie as a child when she was a child. And so she has shared hours of her personal recollections of Annie and life with Annie with me that I'm working to put together in the book. I had hoped to have it out this year. Unfortunately, I got sick and wasn't able to, but I plan to have it out next year.
Do you have a publisher, or are you going to self-publish?
I don't have a publisher yet, and I'm still looking into which is the best way to do it, but what I'm mostly focusing on right now is just getting it all written.
Oh, that's important. Well, I'm sorry to hear about your illness. Is that over, or are you still struggling with the illness?
No, I'm better now. I ended up with a severe lung infection earlier this year that kind of knocked me for a loop, but I'm much better now.
Okay. So when are you heading to Harper's Ferry?
We get there tomorrow. And we'll spend the first couple of days probably in Washington, D.C., so my husband can see some of the air and space museums and a few things he wants to do. Because starting Tuesday night, it's John Brown for the rest of the week.
Okay, so you're from Northern California, so that's a very long hike for you.
Right now we live in Texas. I moved
okay,
to Texas
Alice.
20 years ago.
You moved to Texas 20 years ago?
I did, yes.
Okay. Do you find any John Brown fans out in Texas?
No, not too many.
I don't think you're going to tell anybody in Texas that you're related to John Brown. How about your fans? Have you started getting a following? Have you noticed anybody, really intrigued and want to learn from you?
Yes, I get contacted quite often. The core bunch of historians that I'm in contact with know that whenever somebody wants to find out if they're related to John Brown, they send them to me. People who want to know information about obscure family members, they usually send those on to me. Because the historians, they focus on John Brown and the main things. And if you want to know more about his second daughter, then, they would send them my way. So I do help a lot of people find out more information. I share my information willingly. And I've done some research for some people to see if they were or weren't part of the family.
Okay. So are you thinking about opening your own exhibit? But I know you can't in Texas, but maybe somewhere else?
Well, I actually did have an exhibit in February at my local library with all of my books and my memorabilia. And I gave a lecture on the John Brown family after his hanging, and that was pretty well received. Yes, I would like to do more of that, although I am giving my speech about John Brown's family at the Harper's Ferry commemoration. I'm speaking Friday at 3 o'clock.
Friday at 3 o'clock at Harper's Ferry. Okay, and you mentioned Jean Libby. You said that you made contact with her when at the age of 16. How has your relationship with Jean developed over the years?
Jean has been absolutely wonderful. Thank goodness she kept in touch with me during those years of teenageness when I didn't want to know anything about my family. She has always forwarded me information, and as I got more familiar with John Brown, she has been the one who's given out my name originally to scholars and other interested parties who wanted to talk to a descendant. A lot of descendants will admit they're a descendant, but they don't want to talk about it. I'm willing to talk about it, so I'll answer anybody's questions. So Jean and I have developed a wonderful friendship over the past 30-plus years. We don't like to admit it was that long ago. She actually has featured me, or I'm in one of her books, the John Brown family goes to California. She has my picture that she took of me at 16 and talks about me in the book. And I just received an advanced copy of her newest book, and I see that she put my picture in there and talks a little bit about me in there too.
That's excellent. Is she helping you with your book?
She has not yet, no. She is one of the people I will ask to read it when I get to that point. I've been trying to do most of it myself to start with.
Okay.
Encouraging me. She's always encouraged me in everything I've done.
That's nice to know that you have somebody like that, you know, in your corner. I had a question about your photographs. You have a lot of photographs. You sent us photographs of your family, and we're going to re-air this show after the Harper's Ferry commemoration.
Uh-huh.
And probably again in December, we'll ask you to come back on, and we want to promote your family and through the pictures. Can you talk about some of the pictures, even though we don't have them on my site right now, but next week, they'll probably be on Wednesday night. Could you just talk about some of these pictures and how you obtained them?
I'm pulling them up really quick. Jane is the one who sent you the pictures. Jean is a godsend when it comes to remembering to take pictures at events and take care of things like that. Let's see. She sent a photo of me talking at, I did a presentation at the Saratoga Historical Foundation and Museum in Saratoga, California, which is where Mary and Sarah and Ellen, two of her daughters, settled. They're also buried in the cemetery there. So I know she sent you that picture. Hang on, I'm scrambling to look for my picture. Sorry.
Okay. It's all right.
I know she sent a picture of me at Mary's gravesite. She sent a picture of my father and my brother, I believe, also. I also have an older sister, but she's never been around for the picture taking. She lives
okay.
in Oregon, so she hasn't been around.
Okay, we're down to our last 15 minutes almost. I wanted to talk about the William Steele John Brown connection. We talked about this early on the phone privately. Do you want to start the conversation about William Steele and John Brown? If you remember anything about the two of them?
Why don't you start and I'll pick up.
Oh, okay, William Steele was African American abolitionist when John Brown was murdered as a consequence to his raid. He was hung. William Steele, an abolitionist out of Philadelphia, but he was born and raised in New Jersey, he took care of John Brown's wife. And the daughter sent a locket, a lock of John Brown's hair on behalf of John Brown's wife to say, you know, show their appreciation for his kindness throughout their grieving time. So if you'd like to pick up on, you know, or just express the sentiments that John Brown had towards abolitionists and African-American abolitionists.
He respected all abolitionists greatly. Obviously, he was much more appreciative of abolitionists who shared his idea of equality. There were two types of abolitionists. There were the John Brown type who wanted to free the slaves and have them live in and of America and be a part of it and be equal. And then there were abolitionists that are sometimes referred to as free staters, who wanted to get the slaves out of slavery but wanted to send them away somewhere. They wanted them to go back to Africa or to Haiti or far west so that they weren't with them.
Liberia.
So anyone who was obviously a black abolitionist was obviously for freeing the slaves and having equality. And he did a great deal of work with, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman. He worked with all of those, and I'm not very familiar with William Steele. I do know the story of Mary traveling from North Elba to Charlestown, and she stayed at various abolitionist houses along the way. And, yes, along the way I do know that she passed along letters and lockets of hair. That was actually a common practice back then, to give away lockets of hair. Actually, they sold some before he died, before John Brown died. They cut some off and sold some. And it was not unusual to cut lockets of hair from a person who had passed away as remembrances. And actually, in my archives, I have what I'm told is a little tiny piece of John Brown's hair. I don't know if I really believe it or not, but I bought it on eBay, so I have to take it.
Well, you seem like you're really high-tech with doing your research and your connections. What percentage of your research is done online versus in person and, you know, with family members?
Probably online is probably 70 to 80% of my research. I'm now to the point where I have pretty much seen everything online about John Brown, believe it or not. So I also talk to people, interview people. Like I said, I spent hours and hours with my Aunt Alice discussing her remembrances of Annie. I've talked with other family members. My dad talks to me about some of his remembrances about other people in the family that passed away before I was old enough to realize what a treasure they were. I speak with historians when I need clarification, and I have been to about 5 separate archives now to go through papers and collections and read through things and find information. I'm to the point now where I'm going to have to start branching out of the internet, because I've used everything on it that I can get.
Have you thought about, have you videoed these interviews, and have you thought about putting these interviews on YouTube?
I haven't done them on video. I've done all of them through either phone conversations or face-to-face taking notes. That probably would be a really good idea. It just hasn't occurred to me. It would be great to do for my aunt, you're right, because she's a treasure that is not for the world much longer.
Yes, well, that's what I've done with the Steele family. When I interview them, I have to have the camera there, and you can see some of the interviews that I've conducted throughout the research of my book on YouTube. So I highly recommend that you bring a camera and put all these people on video and then YouTube them if you like. Now, we talked about the books. Could you just go over the 2 books that you recommend? And the next question is related to movies. So let's mention the books first, and then we'll talk about anything in the film.
Okay, the best book about John Brown is called John Brown Abolitionist. Subtitle is The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Seeded Civil Rights. And it's by David S. Reynolds. And I'm walking out to my bookcase to get the name of the other book so that I get it correct.
And what is the name of your book that will soon be out?
My book will be called Silent Warriors, The Women of John Brown's Life.
Okay. And are there any movies that... Go ahead.
The other book I recommend about John Brown is called John Brown, The Cost of Freedom, and it's by Louis DeCaro, and that's D-E-C-A-R-O, and actually anything by Louis DeCaro. He's written 3 books on John Brown.
Excellent. Now, are there any movies? I know you said that your children and you yourself were a little bit upset about how John Brown was depicted in the textbooks. What about movies? Have you seen anything on film that you liked a lot, you appreciated, or you just had great disdain for it?
The PBS special on John Brown was pretty good. I and a number of other historians were a little dismayed that they used a novelist, Mr. Banks, who wrote Cloudspitter, as their consultant rather than a normal historian.
Scholar, right.
It was very well done. The 2 movies from the past, obviously, that everybody hates,
Let's not give them any publicity. If you don't like it, we won't give it any publicity. But you can tell us why you didn't like it.
There are two older movies about John Brown that were made in the 50s, 40s and 50s that are not very good. In fact, one of John Brown's granddaughters sued Warner Brothers over their rendition of John Brown in the movie because it was an insult to her grandfather's memory.
Excellent. Wonderful. Now, are those papers available, that lawsuit?
Actually, I have a copy of the lawsuit, yes.
You are on your job. You can put some, inquiry news about the details of the lawsuit if you like, because I'm really interested in hearing that story. That's fascinating.
Well, she didn't get to sue them, actually. A judge threw it out, but she took them to court because of the defamation of character, I believe is the wording of it. And hang on one sec. I was looking for where it is in my archive so I could pull it up.
So just talk off the top of your head. We don't know as much as you know, so you can go ahead.
She got so far as to getting a lawyer, getting the draft, getting it written up and taking it to court, where it was thrown out because a public figure cannot be you can't complain about how, I don't remember the legal term, but you can't complain about how they're depicted in a movie because they're a famous person. It's just part of them being a famous person, and everyone's entitled to their opinion, basically, is what the outcome of the suit was. But she, it probably got covered. I think I have 10 or 15 news articles from newspapers when she did it that covered the fact that she was suing Warner Brothers over this movie.
Now, are you going to talk about her in the symposium, and is she in your book?
No, I'm not talking about it in my symposium talk, but yes, she's in the book.
Okay, what did your family members or scholars think about that story, and did they know much about the story until you told them?
I've mentioned it in passing to my brother and my sister thought it was pretty impressive that somebody, a woman in the 40s and 50s, tried to take Warner Brothers to court. I mean, that's quite an impressive feat when you think about the 40s and 50s, that a woman would do that. The fact that she sued over a movie is that she had enough love in her heart to sue because they were treating her grandfather improperly is quite a it tells a lot about how much she loved her grandfather.
Yes, and just how, like you said earlier, that his values of, you know, just standing up and speaking up for justice and something she cares about. You said it was very, very strong in your family, and there's certainly evidence that that statement is true. Anyone else in the family? What is her name?
Her name was Nellie Brown Groves.
Can you spell it?
Nellie, N-E-L-L-I-E, Brown, and then she married a man named Groves. Groves.
Wow. And where was she from?
She lived in California. She lived down in Southern California.
Wonderful. Now, more about your book. How long do you think it'll be when you're finished writing it? And what is your greatest goals? And then what are your most humble goals? As far as your book, you know, what do you envision as far as the best things for the book?
It looks like it's going to be about 500 pages, if not longer. My first goal is to get it all written down and get it on paper and at least get it to family members if nobody else gets it. My second goal, obviously, would be to get it out to a lot of people and have people see that, you know, while John Brown is a bigger-than-life historical figure, that there are other people who worked in the sidelines that you probably haven't heard of that are just as important in his battle against slavery and his fight for equality.
Well, we share those sentiments because my book, The Sister Freedom, that was exactly what I wanted to show. And it's really not about one person. It's about all the people, I call them ordinary people, that did extraordinary things that we really don't talk about and don't recognize. So I like the idea that you're recognizing these people and showing the importance of all the people that we don't hear about. Can you, in the last 5 minutes, just explain or describe some of the things these individuals did, you know, some of the people that you think deserve recognition that you talked about in your book?
Well, of course, there's his daughter, Annie, who at not quite 16 went to Kennedy Farm the summer before the raid and took care and kept house for him and the raiders, and more importantly, kept watch to keep what she called her invisibles. That's what she called the raiders because they couldn't be seen by anybody. They didn't want the neighbors to know that there were, you know, 16 men living in this house. So she kept guard, and she writes about it in her later years about how proud she was to have participated in that. There's also Martha, John Brown's daughter-in-law, who made the ultimate sacrifice. She also went to Kennedy Farm and worked, you know, helping take care of the men and keeping them safe. And when she got back to North Elba, she actually took care of the family when they went into basically shock after John Brown's death. She ended up giving up. Her husband was killed at Harper's Ferry. She gave birth to a child who died right after on the new year in 1860, and then shortly after she died. And Annie actually calls her the great heroine of Harper's Ferry.
Okay. Could you tell us more about the Harper's Ferry symposium and celebration and how people can learn more about the commemoration and, you know, just information in general?
The website, again, is johnbrownraid.org. And there are links to the symposium and lists of who's speaking, what days, and what they're talking on. There are links to the events that are happening in a four-state area, including Kennedy Farm in Maryland and Charlestown, West Virginia, Harper's Ferry, and other parts and places around the area. There are probably... This year there were probably 150 to 200 events in the Harper's Ferry area. I think there's probably about 60 left from now till the end of the year.
Okay. Lastly, North Elba, I want to visit this place. Can you describe to the audience what North Elba looks like when you visited there you said last year?
Yes. You pull up a gravel road, and there are no other houses around it, and you come upon a fenced-in area with a wrought iron fence that has John Brown's gravesite in it and a large rock, a giant boulder, actually, that he used to sit on when he wanted to think. It was his thinking spot. And a house that is a standard little 1800s house until you realize how many people lived in it. It had a kitchen, a dining area, a living area, and then upstairs was a flat loft that were for sleeping areas. No, obviously, electricity or bathroom facilities or anything like that, only heated by a wood stove. But when you pull up to the actual North Elba site, it's surrounded by trees. It was just beginning to turn when we went there. It was beautiful colors. And you get a sense of what it must have been like back then to have a house sitting out by itself in this beautiful area. Of course, if you turn your back to the house and you look the other way, you see the ski lifts from Lake Placid. But as long as you keep your back away from there, as long as you look at the house, it looks just like it must have looked back then.
Okay. Last question. What is the demographics of North Elba? Is it the same as it was when he lived in?
Actually, North Elba is probably, it's all expensive houses now, so it's not the same demographic. The houses that were around the town were actually large houses, and it's a ski, you know, being right next to Lake Placid, it's a winter sports venue, so there's a lot of people that come in for the winter and support the area with their money in the winter.
So there's no black people there?
I didn't see any.
Now, what did you do with them? I was just talking with you. Sounds like a great place. You were very interesting. I can't wait to read your book. I'm looking forward to meeting you next week, you and Jean Libby. I hope that you will participate in the interview tomorrow. I think it's scheduled for tomorrow at 6, Sunday at 6. I enjoyed talking to you, and will you come back again in December?
I would love to. Thank you.
Thank you again, Alice, and I have a good night and a wonderful time at the symposium, and I know you'll do well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.